I'm David Schreiner Khan, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Jared Nichols. Jared is a deep future strategist, an executive advisor, speaker, and coach. He provides the tools to help leaders and organizations gain competitive advantage, seize new market opportunities, drive in new revenue, and increase profits. Interestingly, Jared is one of the few people in the world to hold a master's degree in strategic foresight. So maybe we'll hear a little bit about what that means. Jared has worked with Fortune 500 companies, government municipalities, entrepreneurial startups, and professional actors, writers, and directors in Hollywood. So he has a wealth of experience. He's also the host of the Small Business Podcast, presented by the National Small Business Association, titled The Road Ahead, Small Business in the 21st Century. As an author of over 70 articles, Jared has also published Waypoint, Mapping the Future of Talent in the Age of Automation, Rethinking Your Next Quarter Century, which is how to create continuous growth and ensure future relevance. Jared, welcome to the show.
Dave, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So as I often describe it, I see a plateau, particularly for experienced leaders, as somebody who might be in his or her 40s or 50s or maybe 60s, who's been in a leadership role for a while. And a small business owner is really typical of somebody like that. That person may have run one business for a long period of time or maybe has had several businesses. And as we know, there are a lot of shifts that take place in our world, some of which we can foresee, some of which we have control over, and some of which we don't. So somebody like that, they look ahead to what they dream to achieve before their story ends, and they see where they are now. And the gap between the two, particularly if it's not getting narrower, but maybe getting wider, and they look around them at some of their peers, and they see what seems to be breakthrough successes of other people they know, they tend to freak out. And I wonder what your experience has been observing some similar kind of phenomena.
Well, you're touching on a really important topic, and it's one that that I've done a lot of work with folks around. And that's, as you were talking about, getting to that place in their life where they're either seeing that gap of what they had projected as their goals or their aspirations. You know, who knows how long ago? Maybe it was 20 years ago. Maybe it was 5 years ago. That time frame varies from person to person. But what I found is that the reason why that gap will either narrow or continue to expand is due to what I like to refer as perceptual location, right? So in foresight, we like to use the terminology of standing in the future and looking backwards. And this sounds great, but it also sounds very impractical. The reality that I've found with all of us as people is that if we are present day oriented, we're standing right here and we project our goals out into the future, and you know, long-term future, right? So in 10 years, I want to be doing X, or I want to be living here, or whatever it might be. We're doing it from the viewpoint of all the day-to-day stresses, anxieties, excitements, distractions, whatever it might be. Everything that's in our life in a day-to-day moment is informing the specific goal or the direction that we think we're trying to go into. Now, all that's also been based on our past experience. The reason I point all that out is that so often as we're projecting goals out in the future, those goals are going to be limited based on things that are right in front of us, such as, well, I'd like to be able to get over this year and increase profits by X percentage. That's all fine and good. But it doesn't tap into that deep heart aspect that a lot of leaders have, which is retiring for the sake of retiring to make money is not fulfilling. I mean, certainly it's important and people want to have that, so it enables them to do the things they want to do. But where that gap is they're not really clear on what exactly is it that they want to do. And that's where I start to see that gap widening more and more. And so putting people into a position where they can stand 10, 15 years in the future and look back at the different areas of their life and identify what they're most proud of really starts to clear away a lot of that day-to-day fog and stress, or the person that won't move out of the fast lane, or that phone call that you got that you won't remember, it allows you to get much more clear on the type of impact that you were trying to create. Without that, it's a game of whack-a-mole, right? You're going to be lured away by the latest and greatest distraction, and 10 years later wonder how you got there.
So do you have particular thoughts about how one should plan growth?
Yeah, so I mean, if it's personal growth, if it's business growth, the whole way that you want to look at that, if you step back and you look at it, is to identify the beginning and the ideal endpoint of everything that you start. What I like to use is the model, the S-curve model. I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with this, but if you look at the S-curve, it takes a sharp uptick after you've launched and you start getting really good at what you're doing. And many people get to the top of that S-curve where it starts to plateau and decline, and that's when they start to make those decisions of, oh, we need to do something new, we need to grow again. And that's far too late. And you can apply this to the personal life as well. The real place to start making a change is to build on the momentum that you have in the middle part of that curve. So as you're on the incline, you're going up, that's when you want to start creating a new breakpoint that ensures that you have got that same momentum, that you're able to do something new, something exciting, without getting to a place of reaction. So it really comes down to those two things that differ a lot in people's minds is, how do we become more proactive? We're really good at reacting. Well, being proactive is making a break where most people aren't and starting something new in the middle of that curve.
So what's an example, either of something that you've done that has been proactive in the middle of the curve that has avoided that plateau that comes later on, or maybe something you've seen with others where they've done that?
Well, you know, an organization I think has done a great job of showing this through years, because they have the track record to prove it, is IBM. Now, love them or hate them, they've been great every 10 years reinventing themselves, doing something different, recognizing quickly that, you know, early on when they were in the hardware business and that was their primary source of revenue and their value, they realized pretty quickly at IBM that they weren't going to be able to compete with the Dells and the Apples. And so they said, well, we're going to change this up. And they moved their focus to data, and they become the leading big data experts in the world. I mean, hands down, they're on the forefront of that. And so when you look at the way that IBM has recreated themselves, they didn't wait till they were on the down curve and sliding away going, oh, there's no way we can cover. What are we going to do to try and just regain the ground that we had? They recognized that projecting out, they were not going to be able to compete at the same level as these other organizations. And so they changed the model themselves. They said, well, then we're going to do what other people aren't doing. And they created a new market for themselves and reinvented themselves. So they're probably one of my favorite examples that has identified those changes. It's been able to build on the momentum and make that shift that was so critical to the success of their business.
Mm. Now, let's say you're not anywhere close to the size of IBM. Is there another example that people that are small business owners might be able to relate to?
Well, you know, I'd say the model works the same. The impact is going to be different. But the reality is that I've seen this with individuals who are looking to start their own business. People that have been in, say, one career for 25 years. I've worked with folks that have been in that type of situation. One of my clients comes to mind. She was a Disney exec, and she did this for 25 years. And she wanted to get out of that and move into health and wellness, doing advising, consulting in that, where it combined Eastern and Western types of medicine. I mean, this is what she was really passionate about. What her difficulty was leaving all of her skills and her abilities in her former industry and thinking that that's the only place where that has application. So where small business, anybody, whether you're an individual or you're running a small company, can really take this is to recognize that the skill sets that we learn, 99% of them are not tied to the industry in which you learn them. I mean, before I did what I was doing, what I'm doing now, I was an insurance broker for 11 years. And a great deal of the skill sets that I picked up in that world are very transferable to the work that I'm doing now, such as working with organizations. I have a unique perspective on the dynamics of these organizations because, thanks to HIPAA, I got to spend time in closed doors with people at the very entry-level part of the organization to the very top, across so many different industries and sectors, and get to hear what their concerns are, what their perspectives are, because they knew I couldn't share any of that information. So being able to identify where those skills and those areas of expertise that you had in one place can be utilized in another really allows for individuals or organizations to see how they can create new value and anticipate the changes that may be coming down the road, and then position themselves in order to capitalize on that, to not be caught off guard. And so this individual is thinking of transferring all the skill sets she had from being an executive at Disney, really played nicely into the work that she was doing now, but also gave her the credibility to be the expert that folks can call on.
Yeah, it's also, it's really hard to shift out of an executive role if you've been doing it for a long time and you're with a strong company, which also means that you are, I would say, certainly in the upper level of your industry, and people's awareness of you are really tied to that, and you're probably making a good living and doing something that is what seems like a radical shift could be seen as risky. And and from what I've experienced personally and what I've seen with lots of my clients that are in similar kinds of situations, the people who are closest to you can be the biggest naysayers in those situations, which can make the leap of faith to try something new even scarier.
No, you're right. And it goes against the conventional wisdom. You find this in sales, especially, that if you're bringing in somebody new into sales, and you definitely find this in the insurance business, they say the low-hanging fruit are your friends and your family. Well, that's just not true. that's bad advice unless you're just, you know, you see this with network marketing and everything else too, that it's, oh, go talk to your friends and family. Well, the same thing if you're making a pivot in your own business. I mean, when I left the insurance business and went into Foresight, consulting and advising and doing what I'm doing now, the common wisdom would be, well, go back to your existing client base. I had a number of clients, different organizations, and go tell them what you're doing. Well, that's easier said than done, because if you're making such a dramatic change in what you're doing, then in their minds, they're still seeing you in the role that you've played. And it's very much like family. Jesus said that a prophet has no honor in his own town. I believe that was Jesus, right? So the point is that, you know, you've got to get outside of that, and you may find that it's easier to go after a different customer base, a different client base, present yourself in a different area than trying to go back and work the same, client base that you had in a previous career, because there is going to be that hurdle.
Yeah, no, it's interesting that you mentioned that, Jared. I'm thinking about myself. I came out of the nonprofit sector in leadership and management roles, which I had been in for a couple of decades. And when I started my business, which is now 11 years ago, the business really took off when I started picking up small business clients. And that was a totally new kind of customer base and really a new industry for me. I was still using the same skill sets that I had used with regard to leadership and management for most of my career, but it was a very, very different arena.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, different arena. But if you can see that, like you said, your skill sets, your expertise, how it transfers over, because everything that you do in most, you know, aspects of leadership is problem solving, you know, or creating, or in some people's cases, damage control. But all of these things start to build up a unique set of skills and abilities to interact with other people, to make decisions quickly, to be able to think critically. Now, we don't always apply these, of course. You know, myself, I can say that certainly there are times where I should have thought more critically about certain decisions than I didn't, but the skill set was still there. I just didn't make the choice to use it. But it's really finding those and identifying, here's the key skills, the abilities, the outcomes that I'm able to produce based on my experience and what I have done, and then drawing them over to what it is that you're trying to do now. As long as you're focusing on, here's the problem I'm trying to solve or the condition that I'm trying to create for that target audience or for that specific type of customer or client that you're trying to work with. And it's amazing how clear everything gets when you start to see, oh, that 25 years, it wasn't wasted. Not that it was, but it doesn't hold me captive to an industry. It carries over, because at the end of the day, and you well know this, nobody does business with an organization. You're doing business with a person or a group of people within that organization. And so the concepts still apply. the outcomes are very similar. They may be more specific with one group or another, but the skill sets required to interact and to be a strong leader are transferable.
Absolutely. So, Jared, speaking of interacting with other people, and along the lines of trying to make a shift, which is probably, could be a very hard one to make, especially mentally, what have you found are some great ways to get the kind of help you need to be able to make these shifts successfully? And I'm thinking specifically about, help like coaches, mentors, peer support groups. What are your experiences with that?
Yeah. So I'd have to say that that's one of the most important aspects of making a transition. Even if you're in and you're staying in your industry, you're staying doing what you're doing, having that support is incredible, because if you don't have it, then you're going to begin operating in a vacuum. And if that vacuum is just you, that's even worse. But as you begin to grow and you're hitting those new breakpoints, whether it's in your personal life, your business life, you have to have people around you that have been there or have successfully done that, or that have the ability to encourage you and push you on where others may be pulling you back. Because again, making big changes, taking risks that most people aren't going to do it. They're just not human beings. we look for things that will minimize pain and increase comfort. And then there's those crazy folks like us that say, no, I want to keep pushing myself and get better and do this, because a little pain always turns out to be impactful, both for the good and the bad. So the having mentors, having people around you that you can rely on is key. I have business mentors, and I also have peer groups that I'm part of. And you recognize too, if you're growing faster than your peer group, then have the courage to step away. There's nothing wrong with doing that, and find the ones that will push you. And I think that's the key thing. Ask yourself these questions. Has this person here been there, done what I've done, have a track record of success that I know that they can help me because they've helped others like me? And if it's a peer group, ask yourself, is this group here going to push me to that next level, or are they going to hold me back? And just really getting honest with yourself about those two questions can help make the decisions much easier, but you have to have them.
Mm. Is there anything that you found to be counterintuitive about the way a peer support group can be helpful versus an individual coach or mentor?
Well, if you're trying to develop a skill set, so this is the way I look at it. If you're trying to develop a skill set to improve a certain level of competency that you have, then having a one-to-one mentor or coach, somebody who can work with you, help you to measure progress, help you to ask the questions maybe that you're not asking, and then also teach you skills that you can then apply in your own work, that's highly valuable. But when it comes to just having somebody that you can bounce ideas off of or get advice from, having more than one person to do that with, I think, is even more valuable. Having a group of people that you know and you trust, and you also and the big part of that trust is knowing that that they have your best interest in mind when they're responding. And so I think it really depends on what your key end goal is. A great deal of my work is in the transfer of skills, so teaching people, running them through my executive foresight program or working with them on reinvention. It's a skill set transfer. That's hard to do in a group because groups are usually small and you're not spending that much time. Maybe it's once a month, depending on how they've got it structured. But if somebody just needs to have that feedback, want to get insight from different people, different experiences, there's nothing that beats a strong peer group, a strong mastermind group.
Mm. Are there step-by-step methods that you found work really well to either find an existing peer support group or to start one?
Well, let me think here. Methods. I wish I could say, here's the five-step program to identifying an ideal peer group. David, maybe you should write this as a book. But, I think for me, it's been learning to trust that internal signal. When you meet folks, you know where they are. And you can usually know this by their mindset. How are they talking? The way I like to look at it is, are they thinking about crazy things in a good way, about pushing themselves, saying these are the things that they've accomplished and where they're trying to get to next? That's always key. Having a group that has a very specific focus as well is really important. Otherwise, you know, it's just some guys and gals getting together to hang out. But I know for me, and I know for a lot of the folks listening to this here, our time is limited. And if you've got a family, of course, it's even more limited. So being really clear on what type of group this is and what are the collective objectives that we're all trying to get out of this is invaluable. Otherwise, you may end up spending a lot of time and drawing little from it or being able to really contribute much to it.
Jared, what do you see that successful leaders do that other people don't do?
Successful leaders, they take the time to get better. And what I mean by that is they're comfortable spending time with themselves, by themselves. And I've seen this over and over again. All of us, I mean, I know for me personally, recently, you know, we have to go through a reset. And I've just recently gone through a reset, which was great because as my business has been growing, I knew it's going to that next level. And I need to be very clear. And what I found is that I personally, and I've seen this with people that I've worked with, is that when you start to recognize a key indicator, such as if I'm by myself, if I have to have noise, then something's wrong. You know, if I have to have something on in the background while I'm working on a task, then something's wrong. And what I mean is that if I can't sit quietly with myself to be introspective, to assess where I'm at, to be satisfied with the victories, to better analyze the potential obstacles I may be facing, if I can't do that, then I need to change something internally. And so leaders that are really successful, that continue to grow, are the ones that also recognize they don't have all the answers. And not only that, find that to be a huge asset. Say, I'm constantly learning. And I'm constantly learning, and I need to be able to do this and continue to grow. Otherwise, you do get stagnant. And at the rate of change we have in our world today, you tend to fall behind much quicker.
Oh, yeah. So speaking of rate of change, one of the things that you talk about in your book, which really struck me, is how the access to information has really been a game changer in business and in life. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So in the book, I talk about the way that the access to information that we have today as opposed to in the 20th century has restructured our narrative. And this is really about looking at the difference between strategic foresight and strategic planning, because the two, they're not necessarily in opposition to each other. They work nicely together, but many get the two confused. And a big part of that is about creating the context for what we are planning for, right? So when information was limited, we had a handful of sources. There was a hierarchy of information that was passed down. Most of the folks, when I was growing up, my dad watched Peter Jennings, and it was always referred to him by first name. You know, at 6 o'clock, Peter comes on, and that's, you know, that's where he got his news. And information was limited. You look at, you'd have to be in graduate school to get access to all the journals and everything else. Now those things are up and online. So what that ended up, information was more controlled. There was a cultural narrative, a good, bad, enemy, friend. Those things were kind of set in place for us. Now, you may still disagree on certain things, but for the most part, there was a general consensus that, you know, in the 80s, capitalism's good, communism's bad. That was the overarching theme. Now, in the age of information, we have so much information. One, we can't determine what is actually a strong source of information, what's real, what's not real, and that's sadly becoming more prominent in the political dialogue. And
it sure is.
Yeah, that's a whole nother show we could do. But the difference now is that it forces us to really analyze that information. We have to start being better critical thinkers, because with all this information coming in, we start having competing narratives, competing ideas, where one thing that you thought you believed is in complete contradiction to another thing that you thought you believed. And it's because so much information is out there. And at the rate of information we have, if we're serious about getting involved in public discourse or being able to make informed decisions, we have to get disciplined on knowing what sources are good sources. Are we checking our own bias? Because everything is geared towards a specific worldview. I have biases. We all do. There's nothing wrong with that. But you have to be able to recognize those and look for an opposing view. And it really comes down to critical thinking. We have to take the time. We have to slow down in a world that's rapidly accelerating. That sounds like that might be redundant, rapidly accelerating. But we have to take the time to slow down and think critically about the information that we're bringing in, and then determine how is this actually creating the cultural narrative or the context by which we are going to make decisions, both for the present and for the future.
Sounds great. Who do you know personally who has been really remarkable at smashing plateaus?
Oh, man. Well, let me think about that one. You're talking about people that I've interacted with, worked with, or just know. You know, I would say that the first person that comes to mind is a he's been a business mentor of mine and a huge influence on my work, and that's Alan Weiss. Here's a guy who's just recently turned 70. You wouldn't know it if you saw him, but he's continuously grown his work and has evolved and changed over the years, where he started out doing a lot of corporate high level work, and then started to realize that what he had learned along the way could be transferred to people that were trying to do what he was doing. And so I've watched him do that. I think he has now over 70 commercially published books, which is just insane. But he's somebody I've watched change over the years and continues to do that. So he's the first person that comes to mind.
Great example. I followed Alan Weiss, and I haven't read 70 of his books, but I've read a couple of them.
Yeah, and I haven't read all of them either. It spins your head. You're thinking, wow, how does somebody do this?
You need a good system for it.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, I'll give you a piece of advice that he gave us when we were at the Million Dollar Consulting College that he holds twice a year in Newport, Rhode Island. He said, somebody asked him, how do you write so many books? And his answer, and I may be getting this botched here, so Alan, if you ever listen to this, just don't I put that out there. But his answer was great. He said, first of all, I recognize that that I'm a writer, not an author. And his whole point was that he's not a novelist. He doesn't have to sit there and spend years on one book. He said, I write business books about process and, a how-to of how to get this done or that done. He said, when it's 80, he said, I've never written a second draft and recognize me. He's a great writer, but he said, I've never gone back and edited anything. And when it's 80% ready, I get it out the door. I don't wait till it's 100% ready to go, because nobody will ever appreciate that remaining 20%. And then he moves on to the next thing. And he's made that a practice throughout his career. And so I've found that if you start to apply these types of, hey, don't overthink it, just if it's 80% ready to go, then pull the trigger, that actually works.
Yeah, I mean, it's the 80-20 rule in life, which is 80% of our success comes from 20% of our activity.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? So don't overthink that last 20%. It's not worth it.
No, it absolutely is not worth it. So...
it's true. Great example. Jared, what can we look forward to in the near future from you?
Well, I'm excited. I'm working on a few things right now. I mean, one is to take the Executive Foresight program that I've been running with organizations. It originally started out as an online program used in a professional trade association. But my work over the past couple of years has moved that into working with organizations. Now, what I'm going to be doing over the next few months is breaking that down and turning it into a much more accessible program that teaches the skills of strategic foresight, that teaches organizations, individuals, how to think this way, how to plan for multiple future possibilities, how to create strategies in the present that really allow them to be proactive, allow them to be put into a position where they can avoid disruption, ideally become disruptive, and so on. But putting that into an online course that can be accessible to anybody, can be used throughout an organization, doesn't have to be that close, intimate, intensive work that I do with organizations. So that's one thing I'm really excited about. And I would say that's probably the big thing right now.
Yeah. Okay, and how can listeners learn more about you and what you may be rolling out in the near future?
Yeah, so there's two ways. I mean, obviously, there's my website, thejarednicholsgroup.com. There's plenty of free resources there. But another thing that I do is on a weekly basis, I'll be doing it after this show, is I create a weekly video. And it's short, anywhere between 2 and 4 minutes. It's like a newsletter, but I like to say it's because I'm lazy. I'm using video and I don't have to send it to my wife to edit for commas and spelling errors. And so that's another way where they can keep up with me. It's put out a weekly video that gives practical tips and insights. But then if there's anything new that's coming up, I also make them aware of that. And and then of course on LinkedIn, Facebook, I'm in all those places, Twitter as well.
Sounds great. Well, Jared, thanks so much for coming on the show today. It's been a really remarkable discussion about how to think about overcoming plateaus before you get there, which I think is such a great tip for our audience, because we all face plateaus in business and in life. And I think the more strategic we are about planning and trying to make sure that we can face those kinds of hurdles with minimal disruption, the better. So thanks so much for being a guest on the show today. My guest today has been the deep future strategist, Jared Nichols.
Thank you. It was an honor.
Thank you for listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. I hope you enjoyed our discussion. Have you ever hit a plateau in your own life or career? If so, let's talk. It would be my pleasure to take you through one of our free half-hour discovery sessions where we'll get to the bottom of what might be keeping you stuck and how to move things forward. Just give me a call at 212-731-0770. That's 212-731-0770. You never know what you might find out.